Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're all very welcome back. Now with me in studio are popular psychotherapists Helen Villiers and Katie McKenna, who have, well, way too many letters after your name to actually mention. We just say they're mad with brains, if you could say that to a psychotherapist. But they're here to discuss the serious matter of recognising emotional abuse in family relationships, the language and the behaviours involved, and how that impacts the children as they grow up. And more importantly, can they ever fully recover from this? I think yes is the spoiler. Good morning to you both, Helen and Katie.
Good morning.
And I'm going to start with you, Helen, okay. If that's okay.
Yeah.
So in the introduction of the book, and it is a fantastic book, almost so detailed that we'd have to go back to it time and time again. But you're saying that we kind of only learn about the impact of physical abuse in the 70s, then the 90s we learned about the impact of sexual abuse, and now this is new, the impact of emotional abuse and particularly narcissism. It is relatively new to us, isn't it?
Well, I think it's new to the wider population, but yeah. I think as psychotherapists, we've been understanding it for quite a long time. And the thing to recognise is that emotional abuse is the cornerstone of all abuse. Mm-hmm. So physical and sexual abuse can't exist without emotional abuse. Because, say, for example, I went on a date, and on that date, someone, on the first date, they punched me in the face. I'm going to report them to the police. I'm never going to see them again. It's all going to be like saying to my friends, oh, my God, can you believe they did that to me? And then if I was going on the 20th date, and I've had all this behaviour that we describe and you're not the problem, if we go on the 20th date and I've been love bombed and trauma bonded and they punch me in the face, I'm going to find a way to justify it. I'm going to excuse it. And that's what emotional abuse does. It creates an environment where all the other abuses can exist, but on its own can be a thing too.
So that was a one-off. They're not usually like this. Maybe I did something to provoke
it. Provoked it. You find
blaming
a reason
yourself
to blame
and all
yourself.
Those kind of things.
Absolutely.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And it's just literally a timeline.
Yeah.
And you're describing a lot of domestic violence, which we've covered on this show quite a bit as well. But we're talking about the impact on parents, narcissistic parents, on their children in particular this morning, aren't we? So there are five main traits of narcissism.
There are five main traits of narcissism. They are grandiosity, entitlement, exploitation, motivational empathy, and impaired self-awareness.
Okay. Yeah. So we share these out among the team that you have here today. Grandiosity, you'd expect that straight away. So this is, I'm the greatest, everyone is, I'm better than everyone. Is that the sort of...
Yeah, grandiosity would be the big I am. They would be showboating. You know, you can recognise them. They're better than everyone else. And more with the covert or the more insidious is, even if, you know, somebody has a pain in their head, the grandiosity trait is, well, that my pain in my head was worse than yours. If you have a pain in your stomach, mine was always worse. So there's never any space for you in it. It's all about them. They are the sun and they think the world revolves around them.
Okay. Entitlement then?
Well, entitlement is that I want it, so I'll get it and I'll have it. And there's a thing that we have to remember, that these can be healthy. So we can have these traits healthily, but it's where they're toxic and they're hurting people. Mm-hmm. So the entitlement trait is a really good example of that. I want that job. I'm going to climb over whoever I want to get that promotion or job. And therefore, I don't care who I'm hurting to get it. But whereas if it was healthy, it would be, I'm going to work for it. I'm going to earn it. You know, it's that I'm entitled to be promoted because I work hard and I'm good at what I do.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just trampling over people. But as I said, they can be healthy. Are all of these put together, are they the kind of sign of a narcissist, or can you have just one or two of them? We've got entitlement, exploitation again, which is obviously...
Exploitation is... hard for people to recognise when it is in the parent-child relationship, because they are brought up with this. They think that it's normal. Mm-hmm. So what we would see with exploitation in the parent-child relationship is where the child would be encouraged and conditioned to go out to work early so that the parents can take money from them. You know, at such a young age where it's really inappropriate, where the parent can lean on the child emotionally and exploit the relationship.
Right.
So again, it's all about them. They want this for their own personal gain.
But it could be sold as, oh, we want to make the child independent and a go-getter or so on.
Yeah, you've got it, yeah.
But I mean, totally exploited by the parent along the way. Motivational empathy.
It's my favourite one, right? Which I know sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? Like, so motivational empathy, there's a really big misconception in narcissistic personality disorder or just any of these behaviours that there's a complete lack of empathy, and that's actually not true at all. Mm. What there is impaired empathy, and motivational empathy specifically. So it's making you feel bad for either holding someone accountable. So, oh, I'm just the worst person ever. I shouldn't be like your partner, or I'm the worst mother in the world. Or yeah, so yes. It's making you feel bad for calling them out and making you do things against your will because you feel obliged, fear, obligation and guilt. Yeah.
And that just goes on and on and on.
On and on and on.
So is it sort of empathy for themselves or trying to feel the other person feel guilty? Is it sort of pulling on the heartstrings?
Pulling on the heartstrings,
yeah.
Guilt tripping. Yeah. It's eliciting the other person's empathy and their guilt for the narcissistic's own personal gain. So they will make you feel bad for holding them accountable or make you feel responsible if they want something. So yeah, guilt tripping and pulling on the heartstrings is what people might know as motivational empathy.
And just to complete the full bingo card of narcissism, impaired self-awareness.
Impaired self-awareness. Again, massive misconception that there's a complete lack of self-awareness. Mm-hmm. But what it actually is I know that if I do this behaviour, I will get this thing and I will have that need met. So I can exploit you to get that thing and that I feel entitled to. But if I... If I look at my behaviour, if I want to know why I'm doing that, I can't do that as the narcissist, you know?
And as Helen said at the beginning, we all have narcissistic traits and some are healthier than the others. And that healthy narcissism is what makes you ambitious, get ahead and achieve things. Mm. And unhealthy narcissism is the total opposite, because that person intends to cause harm or hurt people. They will use you to get ahead. They'll walk all over you or climb all over you to get ahead. They tell you that they have your best interests at heart, but they don't. And with unhealthy narcissism, you're never taken into consideration because it's all about them.
Okay, so you're thinking of trying to win your Olympic medal this summer in Paris. Mm-hmm. It's healthy, obviously, to say, I am the best, I'm going to be best in the world and so on. But if you're willing to trample over everyone in your life to get there, that's going to be the unhealthy element to it. Can you be one of these things, or is it generally a combination of multiples or all of them?
In order to be kind of considered as having NPD, first of all, a psychiatrist or a psychologist has to diagnose that. There are a number of traits that they would look for in behaviours. But when we reduce it down, these five main traits are the things that we are kind of looking for as a whole. So we'd really want to be seeing all of them together if we're thinking someone is narcissistic.
To identify that. Now, we're talking as though we're trying to identify someone out there going, am I a narcissist? But this is, and all your experience as psychotherapists are dealing with the children of narcissistic parents, presumably as adults, when they grow up and go through their lives and suddenly discover very late, perhaps, that what they've gone through. Is that your experience?
Yes. And with the social media, with the knowledge, we're seeing people a lot younger recognise this. Before this, myself and Helen talked you know, typically we would have seen people in their 40s, 50s recognising this, and now we see it younger. And there's two main things we look for, and that's hyperdependence and hyperindependence. And there's three questions that you should ask yourself. For hyperindependence, do you find it difficult to trust people? Do you find it difficult to ask for help? Do you keep people at arm's length? And if the answer is if the answer is yes to those three questions, there's a strong chance there's hyperindependence there. And for hyperdependence, do you find it difficult to say no? Do you constantly try to please others? And do you find yourself apologising all the time? And if the answer is yes to those three questions, there's a strong chance there's hyperdependence there.
So they seem like two completely different things, but they're traits of the same person who suffered.
And you're right, it seems like two completely different things, but the motivation from all these behaviours is to protect you from getting hurt.
Okay. So people come to you, and I noticed that you dedicated the book to all the adult children of narcissistic parents. You're saying to them, you're not the problem, as the book says.
You're not the problem. When you grow up in these environments, you are taught that you are the problem. You're constantly being told the reason that you're the problem in this relationship is because of your behaviour, the way you are, your character, morally corrupt, that there's something really wrong with you.
Okay.
And you genuinely believe that. Like, growing up in that environment, the clients that we see have this core belief that they are absolutely fundamentally flawed, beyond help, unable to be loved, and don't deserve to be either. And so they are, yeah, absolutely, you're not the problem. It is really making that statement to reinforce that idea.
Does it take a long time to convince a patient that this is what they're suffering?
It would be clients that we would see, and this is not about convincing at all. This is about hearing somebody's story. And although everybody's lived experience will be different, again, myself and Helen see this pattern linked back to childhood. And another way that we talk about this, and you're not the problem, is to identify the roles in the family systems. So there's four roles that we will see, and that's the golden child, and everybody knows a golden child. is the child that the, you know, the parent idealizes and pedestals and thinks that they're perfect. They're not, but in the parents' eyes, they are. Mm-hmm. There's the scapegoat child, and they're blamed for absolutely everything that goes wrong within the family.
Yeah.
There's the invisible child, and that's exactly that. They're invisible. Nobody sees them. They're just completely ignored. They're forgotten.
Are they usually the middle child? Isn't that what the middle child will often say about themselves?
The middle child syndrome. But often we see that the middle child is normally the scapegoat, actually.
Is that right?
Really,
okay,
yeah,
not
typically,
the invisible
yeah.
one.
Okay. Yeah, it's always quite... I mean, look, nobody knows. What we very often see is that the golden child is the oldest boy when the narcissistic parent is a mother. And
right.
Yeah, and that will be...
And it's a daughter if the narcissistic parent is a father?
No, not necessarily. Oh. And so with fathers, it's less predictable, but with mothers, it's very predictable. And that, I mean, look, we could go into patriarchy and all that kind of stuff, okay. But maybe not the right time and place. But yeah, there's a whole thing about boys having more value.
And there was one other role there, the fourth, the gilded child. And we see a lot of these in therapy because these children can think that they're the golden child. And from the outside, they may look like that, but they have to work really hard to be the best friend to their parent. They have to grow up really quickly
right.
to maintain this position.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting because obviously we can understand the suffering of the scapegoat and the invisible child, but the golden child doesn't necessarily have it all easy either.
No,
they definitely don't. And I think that can be a misconception from people because for the siblings of the golden child, they will feel very resentful towards the golden child because they get away with everything. We would hear people say, oh, they'd get away with murder. You know, they're never held accountable. And already we can see the disservice the parent is doing to the relationships because these children, there will be such resentment. They won't be able to have healthy relationships with their siblings. And then because they're not held accountable, we see these people then growing up with such an unhealthy sense of entitlement, and then they can enter into relationships. So if we use that example of the eldest boy, they can enter into relationships then where they want a mother for a partner instead of an equal partner where they're there to support.
And they become quite toxic too, unfortunately.
Right. Mm. Someone's already asking here, lots of questions coming in. Ooh. Can you ask, does narcissism affect siblings? So I presume this is where there's a narcissistic sibling, not the parent.
Well, this is the thing that people find very difficult, is that when there is a narcissistic sibling, there will have been a narcissistic parent.
Really?
It's very, very unlikely. Unless, and so I need to always give a little caveat that there's some kind of influence outside of the family that has been very present. So lots and lots of bullying in very early childhood or, I don't know, abuse in early childhood from a non-parent. That might create the narcissistic sibling, but typically what we see is that the narcissistic sibling is the golden child and that they have got a narcissistic parent, and people hate it because it's brutal.
Because then you've got two of them to deal with. The characteristics of a narcissistic parent, in the book it's 2.5 pages long. There's a long, long list of things. I mean, is there any way on radio of summing up the characteristics of the narcissistic parent?
Oh, well, somebody who's extremely entitled, so they feel like they should know they should be the first one to know all the news. They should be the one that has all the power, all the control. You're not allowed relationships that they don't know about, or they're in all of your business. I mean, we've got three different types of parents, which is the critical, the engulfing, the ignoring, and the fourth one is the combination.
Yes, okay.
Right? So critical parent being very critical, and they're just like not afraid to tell you that they don't like what you're wearing or that they think you're too fat, or, you know, they're really very, very critical. Then we've got the ignoring parent, literally the same thing. They just don't care. They're not involved. They probably don't know what you do for a job. They don't ring you unless you ring them. They've got no interest at all. Then the engulfing parent, who is the one who is in all of your business. You know, they want to know absolutely everything you're doing. They're really the one that would read your diary. They're all over the place. And then, of course, the combination who is all of those things.
And the engulfing parent, this is the one that actually society can think is wonderful because they look so involved. But what they're doing is smothering their child and hovering over their child and wanting to be involved in their life in a really unhealthy way.
I think it's interesting because you describe often that that child is not allowed to be their own person, basically. Yeah.
They're not. They're denied their autonomy. They're denied their freedom because the parent will be meeting their own needs. When we look at somebody that grows up in this environment, we can see if somebody has a narcissistic parent, and we talk about the pendulum. So it's over here. If they were ignored and they say, well, I'm going to do the complete opposite. I don't want to raise my kids the way I was raised. But what we can see is the pendulum swings in the complete opposite direction. And now they are parenting the way they would have wanted to be parented, but not parenting the child and meeting the child's needs. So this is where they're scared to say no to their own child. They never want their child to be disappointed. They want to give them so much love, but they will be love bombing their child and again, meeting their own needs. And that just fundamentally denies a child's autonomy.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of trying to find that balance, isn't it? Because you're describing a lot of things. You'll have people worried now going, am I a terrible parent?
Read the book. Can you find out?
I mean, there are some, the characteristics are quite extreme because it's the parent, the apologies are insincere. They justify their behaviour, brag about you to friends and family, but never compliment you directly.
Yeah, that's one of the trickiest things because it looks like they actually respect you.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. But actually what they're doing is getting the reflected glory. Oh, my child's a doctor and blah, blah, blah. But meanwhile, they're absolutely completely ignored. Ignoring them and not interested at all.
Refusing to treat you like an adult. There are so, as I say, there's nearly three pages of the characteristics there. But the kind of the parents being worried that they might be narcissistic, if you think you're a narcissist, the chances are you're not. is that possible?
I can understand why people think that. And I think it's healthy to ask these questions. And again, when we go back to that there is healthy and unhealthy narcissistic traits.
Yeah.
But it's, do you care about the impact on other people? So when you're thinking if you're the narcissist, a lot of narcissists will say, well, I don't care. That's your problem because it served me well today.
Yes.
And again, we can see Helen mentioned there about the, you know, like the more covert expression of the mother. If you hold them accountable, oh, I'm just the worst person in the world. I can't manage this. Whereas if somebody is questioning whether they are and have these unhealthy narcissistic traits, will they care about hurting the other person? And what we see in our client group is that they deeply care about this. And their biggest fear about being a narcissist is that they have hurt other people and other people have the experience that they had and they never want this.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So, but if you don't care, you're saying the narcissist doesn't really care.
Yeah. So basically, what we see through all the research, and I don't want to be all theoretical and boring.
Well, please
about
do.
It.
We're able for that.
I'm sure you are. I have no doubt you are. But basically, what we see in the research is that when somebody is more overtly expressing traits, that they will be like, "Well, it's your problem, not mine. It's a good thing. It's got me to where I am. I don't care about it. If you've got a problem, on your bike," kind of thing. If they're more covert, they'll be like, how could you even say that about me? I couldn't be, I'd do everything for everybody. And they go into this kind of very victim-y space. But what they don't ever do is say, why would you say that? Why would you be asking that? Why would you be saying that about me? And what can I do differently? How do I need to take accountability? So there's the difference, right? Because yeah, we can be really wounded if someone says you're behaving toxically to us. But what we can then do is go, why do you think I'm doing that? And what do I need to change?
That over presentation, one of the things that they will say is, well, I'm just being honest. You know, the person says, so if you say to me that, you know, Katie, this thing that you've done and it hurts me, well, I'm just being honest. You can't take it. You know, you're too sensitive. You're too much. Again, this message that
you've
you're
hurt
the
me,
problem.
And it's a second wound, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's going to go, well, then obviously you're not able to take.
They're not the problem.
Again, I'm right. And you're once again wrong. I think this is a jokey thing, but they're actually expressing one of the traits. I genuinely think both my wife and I have all these five traits, but we're very happy. Should we be worried? I mean, it's only a problem if it's a problem, right? That's the classic narcissist.
Again, kind of there is healthy narcissistic traits. So for that one that we talked about earlier, healthy entitlement. You know, here in Ireland, I'm entitled to 4 weeks holidays a year. That doesn't impact anybody else. That's healthy entitlement for me to do that. And I'm not hurting anyone else.
Which is what this person's saying. What exactly does achieving things mean? Have you failed if you don't want to achieve things? You just want things to be okay.
you haven't failed if you haven't achieved. So this is a whole social construct that we have to be achieving. And, you know, like, that's absolutely not what we have to be doing. But the thing about what we're trying to differentiate is that healthy and unhealthy narcissism, that it's okay to want a promotion, to want your holiday, to want a bigger house, a nicer car. It doesn't mean you're a narcissist. What it means is you are driven and motivated, and actually they're really helpful things to be. But your life is your life and you choose your path. That's okay.
I think I'm married to one. Is the narcissist aware of being narcissistic, or is their compass out of whack? Can narcissists be fixed, or is it a done deal? Ask this message.
There's two parts to that, really. Mm-hmm. And one, again, when we go back to the traits, is the impaired self-awareness. Mm. So that they know if I do this thing, it will get me what I want. Mm. So they know that A plus B equals C, but they're not reflecting and looking actually at, well, why am I doing this thing? Mm. And typically they can recognize, let's say, these traits in other people. So yeah, for a parent, they could recognize if their parents had these traits, but then they will still say, but I am perfect. I did nothing wrong. And they will be so defended. Okay. The second part of that question was then, is this a done deal? The literature would show that there is an option. If typically people are only diagnosed when they're in mental health treatment, because the narcissist doesn't care about their impact on other people, they're not seeking treatment.
No. Yeah.
So the chances of them entering into therapy and then staying in therapy is very slim, because typically these people, narcissistic people, enter into therapy just to prove their partner wrong, that actually there's nothing wrong with them. Wow. So they might go twice or three times. Mm. And then that's it. They don't stay in therapy. So it's,
it must be in a pretty extreme state as well by the time they go there. Yeah. That would mean we don't know the prevalence of narcissism in our society then, as a result, I presume.
Well, so we do have an idea, but it's thought to be about 0.5 to 1.6%. But
of the population,
of the whole population. But that statistic's thought to be flawed. And the reason is just what Katie said, is that they're highly unlikely.
They
so you know
treatment.
How people stand in the street and take surveys. If you went over and they said, can you do this survey, and we're testing the general population for narcissism, they'd be like, no, because they would know on a level that what they're doing is not okay. They know that there's some, this is where that impaired self-awareness is.
Yes, okay.
So they will always avoid any situation where they might be identified, and so therefore only get diagnosed when they're forced to be by courts or, you know, mental health treatments or whatever. So, yeah.
And as a parent, they would be good at pointing the child away from someone who might expose them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. This is where triangulation comes in. And this is huge in these family dynamics. So the narcissistic parent will triangulate and drive wedges between sibling relationships, parental relationships, other relationships, and especially if somebody else is healthy. So they will typically, if you have a narcissistic parent, they will love if your spouse is narcissistic. And we can see that they are quite aligned, again, which will convince the person in this situation that they're the problem, because they're getting it from their spouse and their parent, because they really don't want this exposed.
Wow. We've loads of questions. I want to come to them, but we have to take a quick break. Okay. We'll take a breath during this and we'll come back to these questions. 51551, that's the text. Now, we're back here. We're with Helen Villiers and Katie McKenna, who are psychotherapists, and we're talking about narcissism. Lots of messages coming in. Someone asking, is narcissistic abuse and coercive control, are they the same thing?
Well, no, but yes. And it's a sort of weird thing. It's that coercive control is a huge part of narcissistic abuse. So you will see coercive control as a part of it, but it doesn't always mean it's narcissistic abuse. So, yeah.
Okay, so there are traits that cause the thing, but it doesn't necessarily mean. Yeah. Can you shine a light on working in a family business with a narcissistic personality?
We can see this a lot, actually, in narcissistic families. A family business, a family farm, and again, the children will be exploited and will have to work in these businesses from such a young age.
Right.
And again, their autonomy being denied, that pressure that I want you to do this thing, so therefore I will convince you even that this is your own choice. Mm-hmm. Whereas what will happen is if you go to step outside and have your own choices and your own autonomy, you will either be, with motivational empathy, the parent can say, oh, I'm just so disappointed. You know, I'm so disappointed in you, to make the child feel really guilty for doing their own thing, again, having their own autonomy and freedom. So we see this a lot. And again, it comes down to control and dominance.
That can be a big thing. But they don't necessarily have to have, the family doesn't have to have any money or high stakes, do they?
Financially, no,
absolutely not.
You can have a narcissist in an impoverished situation.
Absolutely. And I think, again, something that people really get confused about, because we associate narcissists with very high profile, very wealthy people, and actually it's grassroots, everyone is, it doesn't discriminate.
It's a personality disorder, yeah, as you're calling it. Can you tell us what to do to manage the baggage that comes with being the child of a narcissist for their own kids and spouse? Of course, we haven't given much hope yet, so this is this is what you do for a living, essentially, isn't it?
It is. And this is what's called healthy hope, whereas there's unhealthy and toxic hope, that hope that they will change. And maybe if I explain this in a different way, maybe if I just tell them and make them understand. And whereas this is healthy hope, this is where learning the language and the behaviours around to empower somebody, again, to give them their own choice and freedom in this. And we have lots of exercises in the book to help people build identity. Because again, we hear from a lot of people saying, I don't know who I am, because they were never given that freedom to explore that.
What sort of exercises can you do to rebuild your confidence in yourself, I suppose, isn't it, if you haven't had it since a child?
Absolutely. So you're talking about identity building, really, confidence and coping with rejection. And so we do loads of exercises in the book. We've got some on our website, which is insightpodcast.com.
And that's free, by the way, in case people
oh,
think,
sorry, yeah, there's...
Psychotherapy can loads be expensive,
of,
obviously.
Yeah, there's loads of research. So this is why we do what we do, actually, and why we've written the book, because therapy is expensive and it is sometimes not accessible. So we provide as many resources as we possibly can for free. There are obviously paid things too, but regardless, I've forgotten the original question now. Exercises.
It's the kind of hope and what you can do for people. There are some two more interesting ones. This interview explains a lot about my childhood and early adult life. I'm just recently retired. Nice to learn something new every day. And that's what you talk about. Some people don't find out until much later in life.
Yeah, and there can be huge grief with that when people do learn this, because they can look back in childhood and see how things were different. You know, they can see how this was laid down for them in childhood.
I thought you did an amazing chapter on grief, because once you've accepted that you have a narcissist and you can't change that person, then you're going to have to almost let them go in a weird way.
Yeah, and that's the toxic hope that Katie was just referring to, is that toxic hope is the thing that keeps us in there, that the idea that we've got the power to change them, because if we change our behaviour enough, we can change them and the way they react or behave towards us. And actually it's coming to terms with it, we don't have that power, and then grieving it.
This is illustrative of the type of situation you're talking about. Can you ask Helen and Katie for some advice? I don't think you'll do it over the air, obviously. But how to handle a narcissistic mother who is still alive, and we all still, just about all of us, agree to look after her at weekends, even though we have no love for her, wishes she were gone, as she has had such a damaging influence on all of us. I personally feel I have Stockholm syndrome.
This is such a good question. And I think it's really shedding light on something that isn't spoken about. And again, the child can think that there's something wrong with them, that they don't love their parents, love their mother or father. But when we recognise that they were abusive, when we're talking about that grief that somebody goes through, and that can be devastating. But this is actually the hope out the other side of it, that when you grieve, and it's generally not the parent that you've had in front of you, it's the parent that you wish you had, you have the freedom to live your own life. So for this person, it is all about boundaries and about them having their own choices and autonomy.
Great. You're Not the Problem is the name of the book, The Impact of Narcissism and Emotional Abuse Now to Heal. Helen Villiers and Katie McKenna, thank you both so much for coming into us. We'll have to take one last break.
From the North, Tech Studio, followed by your message to 80889.